Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 8, or at least I think they all blend together around these parts. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider. And Payne, we learned an extremely valuable lesson during NFL Week 7, and I'm not sure you know what it is. Would you like me to tell you?
I have no idea.
That if you wrong the bet...
You were not supposed to...
I was going to give you a chance to
bring up Week 7. It's in the rearview mirror.
No, but I mean, there's something that's emerged since we recorded Monday's show, and it's further proof that if you wrong us and the Bet the Board listenership, not only do you lose your job as an NFL starting quarterback, you're relegated to permanent bench duty like we've seen in Indianapolis, who have said, you know what? We're done with the Matt Ryan experiment. Sam Ehlinger, you're our guy going forward for the rest of the regular season.
You brought it up, and I think my joke was from about Saturday evening until late Sunday evening. I would have rather shared a cell with Bubba without money in the commissary for lube, because that was the worst NFL week we have had since we've done this professionally in 2004. Ugly, ugly scene. I will say this, and the part about this, and I think we touched on a little bit on the college podcast, is in the moment, watching it unfold absolutely sucks. But going back and figuring out if it was negative variance or if it was just a bad investment is the kick in the groin, because you got to go through it again.
Yep.
And again, I came away with saying maybe one, maybe two investments that we bet that last week I wouldn't make again. Others, I'm saying, not only am I betting it, I'm adding more to that position the way it unfolded. And again, with the Colts game, I know it's not favorable because most of the public like the Titans, right? So you get some of those comments after the fact, the Monday morning quarterbacks. But you look at that game and Indianapolis outgained the Tennessee Titans again. And to me, there was value in that number. You go back to that Week 4 matchup where the Colts close a 4-point favorite, took steam from like 2.8 out to 4. And now all of a sudden you can get 3 at home or 3 on the road. And we talked about that a little bit, right? I mean, the home field advantage in the NFL from building to building isn't 7 points. And when you have a total that low, and it was even the points scored were even lower than that total, I thought there was some good value there. And we're never going to complain about refs because that stuff doesn't play well. But you have a 9-point game where there's one specific play that leads to a 10-point swing. I mean, you have Matt Ryan on first down, hand the ball off. It's a clear face mask penalty. It should be first and 10 from the Titans 11. And at that point, you can do anything. The entire offense is open. We can run from shotgun. We can pass from shotgun. We can get Matt Ryan under center. We can run the ball from there. We can run play action instead. The face mask penalty is blown. It's second and 13 from the 29, and it's clearly a pass from shotgun. There's only one element there that the Colts can do, and Tennessee sent blitz, and you have the pick six there. So 10-point swing in a game that ends 9, -2 in turnovers, outgained the Titans, and that's how you lose a game.
The postmortem is always the most difficult part of this business, and anybody who has aspirations of doing it professionally, you have to be honest with yourself and go through and mark up and grade your games, figuring out if it was bad beats or if it was bad bets. The last thing you want is confirmation bias impacting further investments down the stretch because you get caught scoreboard watching. But a quick update on the NFL season. When you look at some of the numbers overall, underdogs have had their time to shine. 61, 44, and 2 at a 58% clip so far this season. The rash of unders continues. 58% success rate if you've gone under the total, and underdogs of 4 or more points have been a very profitable type outcome. When you're looking at some of the points per game total-wise, it's the fewest we've seen in the National Football League through Week 7 in any season since 2010. But, Payne, when we look at Thursday night, that hasn't stopped overbetters from supporting this particular total, where the Baltimore Ravens will travel to Tampa for tonight's game. And you're looking at Tampa right now, a 2-point home favorite, total in this game 46. When we talked on Monday, this number had shown wild fluctuations. Baltimore was actually a road favorite. We referenced it on the look ahead number, saying it hadn't moved through a key number, but it had moved through zero, impacting a little bit of the teaser liability more than anything else. Obviously, plenty at stake for two starting quarterbacks. The Ravens with a loss would be 500 or below through eight games for the first time with Lamar Jackson as their starting quarterback. Meanwhile, a loss here for the Buccaneers would mean Tom Brady is two games under 500 for the first time in his career. When you look at the Buccaneers, they've gone under in 6 to 7 games this year. The Baltimore Ravens under the total in 4 straight. Tom Brady, though, an interesting noteworthy nugget here, 15-0 straight up, 12-3 against the spread the last 15 games immediately following back-to-back losses. But this Bucs team just feels different. They feel a bit broken right now. They're a little bit banged up on the defensive side. When you begin to assess Tampa's prospects tonight, Payne, are you more optimistic in their offense rebounding or their defense devising a game plan to slow down Lamar Jackson?
That's both are good questions. And we talked a little bit about this game on the look ahead Monday, and we said, hey, this, you know, is three on the look ahead. We're now down towards pick. And we kind of indicated that the Bucs were going to take some money, and sure enough, they have. Just a weird game. I feel like we've said this more in the first 7-8 weeks than all of last year. But it's part of why this season has been a little bit wonky and professional bettors are having a tough time navigating it, is this is largely an injury report game. I mean, Lamar Jackson missed time last week during practice with a hip, didn't look as explosive against the Browns. Now you're on a short week. Bateman and Stanley were full participants on Wednesday, but both are questionable for the game. I think they ultimately play. But even last week, Bateman played 56% of snaps because not 100%. Gus Edwards even, right? Returned for week 7, and you can say, well, you know, he only played 36% of offensive snaps. But anytime he was on the field, he touched the ball 70% of the time. So he became that workhorse, even though the snap count wasn't overly high. Mark Andrews was dinged up all last week, got in a limited on Friday, which is basically just a walkthrough day. So you have a lot of the key cogs for the Ravens offense that are beaten or will be missing. And I think Andrews is probably the one trending poorly in terms of availability. But for Tampa, their secondary is an absolute shambles, right? Antoine Winfield's out. Logan Ryan is already down. Two of the top three corners in Carlton Davis and Sean Murphy Bunting are out. So this is partly why we've seen this total, to your point, get hit up another wave this morning. So matchup wise, this is interesting because, you know, you have Todd Bowles and the Buccaneers, who are typically a blitzing defense. They're still this season fifth in blitz rate. Lamar Jackson has a 106 passer rating against the blitz. His yards per pass attempt when blitz mirror what he does from a clean pocket. So he's willing to attack when that blitz comes, and the adjusted accuracy doesn't dip much when blitzed. Now, if you strip out some of the fumbles when Lamar's blitzed, his EPA enhances big time. He's been pretty good there. But the one thing we know is the biggest chess piece you can have when playing the Ravens offense is a versatile safety. And it'll sound bananas, but I think in this specific game, Antoine Winfield Jr. missing might be worth a point. He's good enough in coverage to defend tight ends. Ravens target their tight ends a lot. Winfield is second on the Bucs in sacks, so Bowles likes to send him on these blitzes. Winfield also has graded out the best run defender and tackler in Tampa's defense through 7 weeks. And you think back the last few seasons, right? The defenses that have had a better time stopping Lamar were the ones that could play faster guys on the field while not losing the physicality. So if you have a safety that's fast enough to blitz and play sideline to sideline in the run game, but give Mark Andrews fits in the pass game, it was a huge help. Now, what we've seen from Bowles this season and even more last week was blitzing, but playing too high shell behind it to protect his injured secondary. The Buccaneers are fourth in the league in usage of too high shell, but since the start of last season, Lamar Jackson has the seventh best EPA among quarterbacks against those two high shell looks. So he's been pretty successful there. So you can kind of see the path for Lamar and the Ravens offense having success here, especially with Tampa's secondary. But can Baltimore take full advantage knowing Andrews might not play. If he does, he'll be a shell of himself. Gus might not play. If he does, on a short week with the injury that he's recovering from, might not have a full load. Bateman isn't 100%, might not have a full load. So that's the interesting component here. And you just look over the last 4 weeks, we talked about, you know, Lamar potentially being an MVP candidate guy. He struggled the last month. I mean, he's just trending poorly. 27th out of 35 qualifiers in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation during this last four-game stretch.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it. I mean, over the first three games, just from a yards per attempt standpoint, if you want to get real simplistic with Lamar's numbers, he was at 8.5 yards per attempt over his last four games. He's now sub six. The passer rating has fallen off a cliff from 119 to 70.4. So you definitely see some red flags there. And with weapons along the lines of Kenyon Drake and Isaiah Likely, a far cry from Gus Edwards, J.K. Dobbins, and of course, Mark Andrews, who we know when healthy can be the most dynamic tight end as far as overall weaponry are concerned, especially given the chemistry and rapport he has with his starting quarterback. Now, on the other side, obviously the Tampa Bay Buccaneers have experienced nothing but pain on the offensive side, kind of bottoming out last week with a three-point outburst against the Carolina Panthers, tied for the second largest upset loss in Tom Brady's career. The Buccaneers' 3 points are tied for the second fewest in a game that Tom Brady has ever started. They've now gone 8 straight games without a first quarter touchdown, the longest streak in Tom Brady's career. I mean, pain. We can take the low-hanging fruit, which is a non-existent ground game where Tampa is dead last in the league and from a historical standpoint hasn't been good by any stretch of the imagination. Can they fix all that ails them in the passing game, knowing they're down a couple of weapons there against the Baltimore Ravens defense that'll be without Calais Campbell, but the secondary has improved, obviously, this year given the health they've had in that unit compared to where they were last year?
You know, I think it is a little more straightforward on this side of the ball, and relative to the Green Bay Packers, there's certainly more talent for the Bucs to kind of right this ship. And you just wonder really about both buy-in from the players and the acumen of the coaching. I mean, this is something we hinted at could be a problem in our preview podcast. I went back last night and looked at some of the notes and played back what we had discussed specifically about Todd Bowles crushing this offense with more runs this season, and the quotes that were coming out of camp. And, you know, we were lower on Byron Leftwich compared to public perception as well. And the Buccaneers offense, despite playing, you know, some musical chairs at wide receiver with guys in and out of the lineup as they recover from old injuries or have new injuries or, you know, even suspensions for Mike Evans for a game, you name it, Buccaneers are still 9th in schedule adjusted pass efficiency on first down, 29th when running. And somehow Bowles and Leftwich continue running far more than they should on early downs relative to the success they're having between running and passing. And, you know, maybe the early down runs won't be as inefficient tonight because the Ravens are 23rd in defensive rush efficiency. And as you pointed out, their big fellow there, Calais Campbell in the middle, is out. Tom Brady probably not going to be under pressure as much as you'd think either. The Ravens are 26th in pressure rate. And, you know, I think we have to question the health of the Ravens secondary a little bit. I know those guys are out there, right? Marcus Williams, Marlon Humphrey, and Marcus Peters, they're playing. But they've each been banged up this season. They're not playing at 100%. I mean, Jacoby Brissett went nuts last week. He was the number one quarterback in completion rate over expectation for week 7 because you saw those guys just playing at a fraction of their normal level, even though the bodies are out there. And sometimes that's how you can find value in the market, in that these guys are playing, the screen doesn't light up, but they're just a shell of themselves. We also talked a little bit about the Bucs offense on Monday. It just feels like they're searching for confidence. You know, they're like that jump shooter that just needs to see the ball go through the hoop. And they could have started that Panthers game fast. Mike Evans dropped a 65-yard touchdown 90 seconds into the game. And then possessions 2 and 3 reached the Panthers green zone. But Byron Leftwich in his early down runs happened and those drives fizzled. So, you know, Brady's going to be down a couple of weapons tonight. You referenced that. Russell Gage is out. Mike Evans will play, but kind of hobbled around the Panthers game late with an ankle injury. He's less than 100%. But there are some underlying indicators that improvement could be coming for the Buccaneers offense.
Have you been surprised by how much the side and total have moved on this game? Kind of the last point here before we move on to a trip to good old Wembley Stadium.
I think if you are believing the Buccaneers offense will do the right thing and open this up and pass the football based upon the Ravens secondary not being 100%, you can make a case. And then when you look at the Ravens, or I'm sorry, the Buccaneers defensively, right, in their secondaries just in shambles, you can understand why this is ticked up from a total perspective. I don't know where we go from here. In terms of the side, the way the Ravens are trending a little bit, it doesn't completely shock me. Now, we've seen a situation like this last year, right, where the Ravens traveled to Florida on a short week, and it was struggle bus. So this does feel, as odd as this sounds, like a big game for Tampa. I understand, right, Tampa wins, like both teams are 4-4. It just feels like there's more at stake here for Tampa Bay.
Yeah, you kind of have to hold serve at home in this kind of spot. Nobody, obviously, in the NFC South is running away with it. And despite all of Tampa's struggles, you come out of this week at 4-4. You're still very much, obviously, in control of your own destiny in the division. When the biggest contender for your supremacy atop the NFC South coming into the year was the New Orleans Saints, and we know they're dealing with heaps of issues. I'm not buying the Panthers or necessarily the Falcons as legitimate threats as the season goes on. But
yeah, agreed. You know, it just feels like if Tampa were to do the right thing offensively, like it's there for them. Yeah.
They haven't shown that yet.
You're battling mentally. Yeah, they haven't. No, they haven't. And it's that's why, you know, frustrating because you know it's there.
Time for a little breakfast football come Sunday morning, 9:30 kickoff Eastern time, 6:30 for those of us out here on the West Coast. And what a treat we have. It's the Jacksonville Jaguars annual pilgrimage to Wembley Stadium. This time they'll be laying 2.5 points to the Denver Broncos. Total in this game, 39.5. We did see this number on the side open significantly higher through the key number of 3 at one shop. Also opened at 3 at some other books. When you look at Jacksonville, they've played here once a year, every single season, other than the COVID year going back to 2013. New head coach, but the organization has this process down to a science since they've done it so often. Both teams come in mired in a 4-game losing streak after 2-1 starts to the year. Nathaniel Hackett apparently already on the hot seat just 7 games into the season. If you read some of the articles coming out of Denver, more on that in a second. The Broncos players forced to ask questions about continued trade rumors around key personnel, saying a loss here might have the Broncos sending a lot of those key pieces out into the trade market. When you look at Denver overall, they're on a 6-1 under run this season, 18-6 to the under since the start of last season. The 30.7 points per game we've seen in Broncos contests is the shortest number since the Kansas City Chiefs back in 2007. Meanwhile, Trevor Lawrence, he hasn't exactly lined people's wallets as an NFL starting quarterback, 7-17 against the spread in his career, tied for the worst record by a quarterback through 24 career starts since the 1970 merger. And when you look at Trevor Lawrence, it's Baker Mayfield, Matt Rhule type stuff we're seeing here. 0-17 in his career when a Jaguars opponent scores 21 plus points. 1-19 in his career when the opponent scores 12 or more points. So not a ringing endorsement for Jackson's ability to win a track meet. And to my point earlier about Denver, I mean, you have writers talking about it being a total panic in Broncos country. You have Russell Wilson doing high knees on plane rides while everybody else is sleeping. Payne, I'm not sure what to think of either of these
feels
two
like
teams.
Feels like a Johnny Drama
because Jacksonville
move.
Was obviously a dark horse to win the AFC South. They start off well. They've since petered out. The Denver Broncos, it was Super Bowl or bust. Coach Hackett and Russell Wilson were saying that. Right now, the biggest question for Denver isn't about winning a Super Bowl. It's can they score 20 points in a National Football League game?
So the movement on this one is interesting. From Denver +4 Sunday night down to 2.5 as we talk. It's Russell Wilson related. And the next move will be the most telling one. Do we head down towards pick, or do we push back towards the key of 3 as limits increase? Denver's a little beat up. You know, we know Garrett Bowles and Ronald Darby are out for the season. Randy Gregory's on the shelf, and his replacement, Baron Browning, is also out. And when I look at this one, Jacksonville, through 7 weeks, has really mastered the ability to screw shit up. And, you know, metrically, they're pushing towards being a top 10 team, if you can believe that. There's just too many situations unfolding weekly, similar to what we saw, you know, against the Giants, where, you know, Jacksonville has 4 trips that touched the Giants 9, 5, 20, and 1 yard lines that resulted in a grand total of 3 points. It's just tough to win games and close them out doing stuff like that. So when I look at this matchup, it would indicate that Jacksonville should have a real edge on the ground here. You know, the offensive line is top five in yards created before first contact per rush, seventh as a team in schedule-adjusted rush efficiency. I know Denver went out and signed DJ Jones, and he's kind of continued to be that monster on the interior, still number one in run-stop win rate among defensive tackles. But as a whole, the Broncos are below average in defensive rush efficiency, and that's against a below-average schedule of run defenses. Denver's given up more than 4.8 yards per rush to running backs. That's seventh worst. And I think the key here, at least for Denver defensively, you have to stop Jacksonville on the ground, especially right now, right? Force Trevor, who's lacking in confidence, and the guys around him are lacking confidence in Trevor Lawrence. That's got to be the goal. So you should have, I mean, I think when you think about this, right, it's like we just got to sell out to stop the run, force Jacksonville's passing attack to put it into the strength of your defense. And if that can happen, Denver kind of tightens its weakness and you have them playing into your strength. And I think that's potentially where Denver has the shot here, because their secondary has just been elite, right? Third in schedule adjusted defensive pass efficiency. Simmons is back. You pair him with Surtain and it's that elite corner safety duo. Denver's allowed one touchdown to receivers all season. And just kind of looking at where you can maybe attack Denver defensively through the air, there's really only one spot, and it's in the slot, and it's just a slightly better than above average proposition. But if Jacksonville's going to have success passing, got to be Christian Kirk dominating the slot. Broncos have given up 8 yards per target to slot receivers. That's 17th. But again, this comes down to, I really think if Jacksonville can run it, they're going to win this game. If Denver can stop the run and force a quarterback that's lacking in confidence to throw it into their strength, things can go awry another week for the Jaguars.
Kind of curious to see what the workload starts to look like for Travis Etienne. He has carried the ball 10 plus times over the last three games, but if Doug Peterson's track record and history is any indication, he's not the kind of head coach that wants to give one of his guys 25 plus touches, whether it's a combination of rushes and receptions. So we'll see how the Jaguars handle that backfield situation with no James Robinson, who was shipped off to the Jets earlier this week. Last thing,
McHasty, baby.
Yeah, I mean, hey, you know what? He's shown a little bit of burst. We know he has been a journeyman personified, so we'll see if he's good for, you know, 6 to 8 touches there to show a little explosion to try and spell Travis for stretches. All right, from London to the Keystone State, where East meets West in the battle between the Eagles and the Steelers. Philadelphia fresh off a bye, a 10.5-point favorite, as they'll welcome in the Pittsburgh Steelers. Total in this game, 43. The last time, Payne, these two teams met without either Big Ben or Donovan McNabb as starting quarterbacks, way back on November 23rd, 1997. Yes, I know they don't play every single season, so it's all relative. When you look at this Philadelphia Eagles team, they're outscoring their opponents 112-27 in the second quarter this season. Most points, 112, and best score differential by any team in any quarter through six games since 1940. What's more impressive about that, the Eagles have more points in the second quarter this year at 112 than the Steelers have overall at 107. The Steelers, three games as an 11-plus point underdog. We'll see if that holds true since 1970. It happened once earlier this year. We know how that game ended against the Buffalo Bills. Pittsburgh, pretty fortunate to get inside the number against the Miami Dolphins on Sunday Night Football. They lost that game 16-10. The scoring differential, the worst through seven games since 1989. And win or lose, the Steelers will have their worst record through eight games since 2013. We knew that a rookie quarterback was going to have struggles. Kenny Pickett, along with Mitchell Trubisky, have contributed to the lowest passer rating of any team in the league. In steps of Philadelphia defense that has two lockdown corners in Darius Slay and James Bradbury performing at an elite level. The Eagles go out and address one of the concerns they had defensively in bringing in Robert Quinn for a fourth round pick from the Chicago Bears. If there's one way to attack the Eagles, it's running the football. But Payne, I haven't seen enough from this Steelers offensive line and Najee Harris to lead me to believe that Pittsburgh can have a sustained level of success playing keep away from this high-powered Eagles offense.
Yeah, these are the types of games that are difficult to handicap because the number shouldn't be 11, but the matchups aren't great, to your point. Core number here is more like 9.5 when you think about the Steelers playing the most difficult schedule in the league through 7 weeks and Philly playing one of the 10 easiest schedules at this point. And, you know, I've seen some sharp value bets come in at plus 11. That's why we're down just a tick. So, you know, some general thoughts here. And when I go back to what I said in our season preview about Pittsburgh and how on the surface all their young weapons create this appeal. You have Pickens, who's certainly come on and shown to be a number one receiver already. And you have Deontay and Claypool and Najee, even though he's banged up and we are kind of selling him in the market. The O-line we thought was going to be horrific. And the quarterback play wasn't overly appealing. So it's like having this Ferrari body, but a Pinto for an engine, because all of the key components here just aren't playing well. And you look at the Steelers' offensive line, they aren't getting much push in the trenches, to your point, 25th in adjusted line yards. But what's really interesting here, when you think about the Eagles' defensive line with Hargrave and Cox and, you know, Jordan Davis, who you know spent a decent amount on in draft capital, when you adjust for schedule, the Eagles are below average in yards per rush before first contact. They are 24th in adjusted defensive line yards. So maybe it's not total domination that you'd expect up front there. Through the air, I mean, I know the Steelers fans won't like hearing this, but Kenny Pickett's been pretty poor. And he's currently 24th in QBR behind a guy named Matt Ryan, who was just benched. And, you know, surprisingly, though, the quarterbacks, whether it's Mitchell Trubisky, whether it's Kenny Pickett, Pittsburgh finds themselves top 10 in both pressure percentage allowed and pass block win rate. That's something we did not expect for that O-line. And, you know, even last week against a very blitz-happy Miami Dolphins team, Pittsburgh's offensive line did quite well there. So, you know, the O-line hasn't been horrific in protection, and Pickett's not really getting rid of the ball at an enormously quick rate. I mean, it's slightly better than league average, so it's not really causing distortion in the pass block numbers. The reservations I obviously have about Pittsburgh's passing offense was watching last week unfold. You know, I mean, that was one of those like sneaky games where you could see a path to an over, especially with a depressed total due to, you know, Tua missing substantial time. And you're looking at Pittsburgh, they had played the second toughest schedule of defenses. And so they were dropping down in class to a 20th ranked Dolphins unit who was beaten and battered without Byron Jones still, and Nick Needham and Ogba, and later Brandon Jones left with an injury. And Pittsburgh just wouldn't push the ball downfield or rely on Pickett and the receivers. And so that's, to me, scares me a little bit here. And what I really wanted to target in this game was the total. Right, we were hoping the reopen would be close to the look ahead of 45.5, but unfortunately the reopen was below the key of 44. And, you know, you just quickly on the other side, right, you're looking at a Steelers secondary that's getting a little bit healthier. And defensively, the Steelers are sixth best in opponent rush yards before first contact. And we know the Eagles offense, they have a run rate over expectation. So that's kind of the first step there on that side of the ball. And you have a Steelers defense that's used to playing a mobile quarterback in Lamar Jackson multiple times a year. So they're familiar with that dual threat. And then you have the component of, you know, if Philly does take an early lead, they have really shown a propensity to just take the air out of the ball in the second half. But, you know, our number was like 42.9 here, Todd. And so, you know, we're kind of left sitting on the sideline as 43 is here. And we just, I was hoping that this would open a little bit higher on the reopen, because the look ahead was certainly showing some value here. But I just, it's one of those tough games where it's like, I know 11's a little bit too much, but I don't love some of these matchups.
Yeah, I'm real curious to see. I mean, I know the Steelers' run defense has been better than we thought they could be coming into the season, given what we saw for extended stretches last year. But let's see how they defend Philadelphia. The Dolphins did have a level of sustained success early on in that game. The Steelers, to their credit, made some adjustments, and that game really bogged down after 26 points were scored in the first half. So we'll see what Philadelphia looks like out of the bye. If there are a couple wrinkles there, and if Pittsburgh finds themselves behind, do they trust Kenny Pickett to throw them back into the game? The one bright spot, when he did target George Pickens, it's reaped a tremendous amount of benefits, and that appears to be his number one receiver, more so than even Deontay Johnson. But from an early game in the city of brotherly love that I'm sure will be foaming at the mouth for the start of the World Series on Friday night, to the West Coast, where the Giants are on the highway for the second straight week, last Sunday in Jacksonville, this week in Seattle. And Payne, this is the only matchup of the entire Week 8 schedule that pits two teams with winning records against one another. I'm not sure what kind of price I could have offered to you before the season that this would be the game to circle, but here we are. A pair of top 10 teams in offensive efficiency. The Giants were listed at 9-1 to win the NFC East before the season. The Seahawks, extremely long odds at 25-1 to win the NFC West. Over the past 20 seasons, though, teams that come in 6-1 or better as an underdog in their eighth game of the season, 10-1 against the spread, 9-2 straight up. The Giants have exceeded odds makers' expectations not once, not twice, not three times, but five times this year, going 5-0 straight up and ATS as an underdog. The second coach in the Super Bowl era to pull this off, and Coach Dable joins Bill Cowher in rarefied air. Meanwhile, Daniel Jones, we've talked about at great lengths. I mean, this is a quarterback that you bet on the road. You look to fade at home. His road record against the spread, 15-6 away from home. Meanwhile, Geno Smith has been dominant as a starting quarterback over his last 15 starts, going 12-3 against the number. Wednesday practice report for the Giants, a little bit nicked up at the skill positions. Silver lining there for them, Wandale Robinson, who was a non-factor in the second half against Jacksonville, not even listed there. Saquon Barkley continues to dominate in his resurgence as a running back, leading the league in scrimmage yards and touches. When I look at this Giants offense, Payne, Daniel Jones clearly looks the part, playing with a chip on his shoulder. Seattle's defense is extremely vulnerable. We've seen them give up chunks of yardage. Do the Giants have the playmakers to be able to play on their front foot in what is a very difficult situational spot, explaining why the Giants opened under a field goal underdog for the second straight week? They're bet out to a full field goal dog with a total that sits at 45.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to love what's going on in New York, obviously. You know, Dabes and Cathcart, sharp and forward-thinking, and if you watched closely last week, you could tell they didn't rest on their laurels. They're pretty self-aware. They understood that, hey, you know, we're 5-1, but our offense isn't great starting games. What can we improve? And immediately against Jacksonville, you saw a shift to fewer second down runs. Daniel Jones, to your point, his legs were more involved, and the Giants threw from heavier sets, knowing the receiver group isn't anything to write home to mom about. And, you know, those changes certainly helped the Giants beat the Jaguars, along with a little luck that we've referenced in the last podcast and earlier in this one. But most times, if you do the right things, luck tends to follow. I do think if you kind of injected Dabes and Kafka with the truth serum, they'd be the first to tell you they're not the seventh best offense in the NFL. And that's where they sit in terms of schedule adjusted efficiency through 7 weeks. I mean, you can kind of just tell, right? Like what they're doing offensively is, and they've managed to squeeze blood from a turnip is basically what you're watching here. And, you know, specific to this week, Giants are a little beat up, obviously. The travel is a bear. You know, you go from New York to Florida, Florida to New York, New York to Seattle. Your starting right tackle, Evan Neal, is out. Starting guard, Ben Bridson, out. Starting tight end, Daniel Bellinger, is out. And I think when you look at Bellinger, he's not only more involved as a pass catcher with heavier usage of 12 formation that we talked about, but he's a damn good pass blocking tight end. And he was kind of acting as that sixth lineman at times. Evan Neal isn't great. Still kind of learning the ropes, so the immediate drop-off might not be huge, but you got to keep an eye on his backup, Tyree Phillips. Phillips is battling a toe injury. So that will be huge, because all of a sudden, if you go from right tackle number one to right tackle number three, a little bit of a drop-off there. So keep your eyes peeled on Tyree Phillips this week in the injury report. This is a step up in class for the Seahawks defense, which you're kind of referencing and hinting at there. They faced the seventh easiest schedule of offenses this season. Now they're facing, you know, number seven New York Giants. So it's a little bit of a step up there. Quietly, though, if you're paying attention, the Seahawks defense has made some improvements, and I get it. You faced the Cardinals offense. They were injured. You faced the Chargers offense, which was really injured. And certainly there were a slew of missed opportunities and plus territory for both the Cardinals and the Chargers that lead you to believe some of the Seahawks defensive improvements aren't as real as you think. But if you look at some of the down-to-down stuff, there's improvement there. I mean, first 5 weeks, Seattle's 31st in EPA per play allowed and more than 46% of snaps graded successful. Last 2 weeks, third in EPA per play allowed and just 34% of offensive snaps have graded successful. Even better against the run. Only 28% of runs have graded successful the last 2 weeks against Seattle. So if you're Kafkin, Daboll, yes, right? Test Seattle's run defense with Saquon, see if this recent two-week sample of improvement is real or if it's just because both the Cardinals and Chargers played from negative game states and are both in the bottom third of the NFL in schedule-adjusted rush efficiency. You have to test that out. If it's real, then you got to get Saquon involved more in the pass game because Seattle is dreadful there. They're bottom three in yards, receptions, and EPA allowed to running back passes. So that's the way you would get the pass game going. You mentioned Wandell Robinson. I think that's interesting. He does seem a little bit healthier. And at this point, if you are going with more 12, which without Bellinger, we'll see. Do they have enough tight ends on the roster to do that? But if you are going with heavier sets, the two receivers that need to be on the field in those sets seem very clear to me. It needs to be Wandell and Slayton. I know they weren't high on Slayton initially, but he's kind of proven himself to at least be their second best option. My instincts here, Todd, are kind of telling me that, yes, we've seen respected money on this under come in at 47.5. We are now trending towards the largest key number of 44, because we're at 44.5 across the board, basically. I think we have to keep our eyes on the weather here, because as we record, 14-mile-per-hour winds, a 55% chance of rain in Seattle on Sunday. But if that clears up and we get to 44, I think we will see a difference of opinion on this total. But those two things have to be in play, in that you see a 44 and the weather's improving for an over to unfold in this market.
Coming into the season, did you assume that Geno Smith was going to have the third best passer rating to this point in the year behind only Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen? Was that something that you forecasted when you rubbed your crystal ball and tried to figure out, hey, look, I think about a resurgent offense. Geno Smith is going to be the catalyst to making Seattle offensively relevant with a high-flying passing attack aided by the emergence of a talented rookie running back in Kenneth Walker. Those weren't things that you thought of, Payne?
I think what we thought was Seattle's defense was going to be a dumpster fire, which for 5 of 7 weeks it has been. And we had heard positive things about Geno, but then when Pete made this a quarterback competition a week before the season, we're like, geez, this is going to be ugly. And so a lot of guys found sixes that were available in the market and went under. And that is going to be just a dead nut loser. So
I may
did not anticipate this.
I may or may not be one of those guys that has an under six win total ticket for Seattle. So I'm hoping that there's complete carnage for the Seahawks between now and the remainder of the season. 6-11, Seattle. Let's go make it happen. But DK Metcalf looks like he is a long shot to play. I haven't seen him officially ruled out, so it'll be interesting to see what the Seattle offense looks like. But we know it's run heavy. The Giants have been vulnerable in that particular department. So it should be a fascinating game when you look at both sides of the ball and two fan bases that I'm sure are extremely excited about where their teams are that did not expect to be here coming into the year. The Seahawks, as we mentioned at the top of the preview, the lone team in the NFC West with a winning record right now. Still not exactly favorites by any stretch to win the division, but a lot more reason to be excited about what this team can put forth over the next 10 games.
I think there's something interesting, you know, on this side of the ball, because there's going to be a path here for Seattle to have some success. And I think right off the bat, you're looking at their run offense. You know, I mean, the Giants, again, when we look at this record, God, I love that they're good. But internally and everything that's going on there, it's a surprise to them as well. And the Giants right now are 30th in schedule adjusted run defense. They're dead last in yards per rush attempt before first contact. So if you look at opposing running backs, they're averaging 2.5 yards before they're first touched against this Giants defense. Only one other defense has a 2 in front of their name. Okay, so they just have not been good there. And I think that's going to allow Geno to play from some neutral down and distances, especially when you think about the Giants defensively allowing a league high 7.4 yards per play on first down. We know Seattle's done a really good job starting fast, building leads. 7 touchdowns in the first quarter. That's most in the NFL. So you build the lead. And then you let Kenneth Walker feast, to your point. And he didn't get a ton of snaps early in the season. Obviously, he was battling a little bit of an injury. Then he was in a timeshare with Rashad Penny. But to this point, 10th in defensive adjusted value over an average running back. The last two games, the Giants have given up 233 rushing yards on 24 carries to Kenyon Drake and Travis Etienne. No one loves the Drake more than me.
Love the Drake.
So you mentioned DK Metcalf. Like, thank God the injury doesn't look as severe as first anticipated. And even though it looked terrible, when I saw him on the cart, he whispered something to somebody and said, like, not that bad, or something along those lines, he intimated. And the guy's a robot, so I don't think he plays here, but it's not as severe as initially anticipated, which is great for Seattle fans. Tyler Lockett also playing at less than 100%. But the one thing that's interesting that creates some variance on this side of the matchup, Seattle's pass game against the Giants' pass defense comes with this just battle in my mind, because the Giants lead the league in blitz rate. And so because of that, their pressure rate looks damn good, but they're not overly efficient actually getting pressure on like a pure snap basis, okay? And you'll see in the numbers that Geno struggled against the blitz. But I don't know if the Giants are going to actually get to him. And the bigger component to the blitz is the coverage defense's play behind it. So the Cardinals gave Geno problems when they blitzed a few weeks back, and I think people are thinking about that correlation. But Vance Joseph plays zone behind his blitz. And I think that's important to understand that, you know, it's a little bit different here because Geno has been bad against the blitz, yes, but he's actually top six in just about every single pressure metric from success rate to EPA. So you're asking yourself, like, why is the dichotomy here? When you dig deeper, it's actually not just the blitz, but the coverage behind the blitz. And unlike the Cardinals, when the Giants blitz, Wink plays man coverage behind it. The Giants play the highest rate of man coverage in the NFL. Geno is substantially better against man coverage. Geno is actually the quarterback that's most sensitive and has the largest zone to man dichotomy among qualifying quarterbacks. So against zone, Geno has a negative 0.3 EPA per dropback. He's averaging a shade more than 7 yards per pass attempt. Against man, woo-wee, Geno has a positive 0.62 EPA per dropback. He's averaging 10.4 yards per pass attempt. So it's one of those conversations that we've had, Todd, specifically about Wink. It's, does he stay true to his scheme? Does he conform a little bit? We know Baltimore let Wink go because he had the unwillingness of throwing that curveball.
Every now and again, you can't just come with a 105-mile-an-hour heater right down the middle and dare an opposing hitter to try and take a swing at it. You got to come with the off-speed stuff, throw a little wrinkle, and get their timing completely off kilter. Also in the afternoon, Payne, two teams in the NFC West that'll be doing battle, renewing acquaintances, the San Francisco 49ers and the Los Angeles Rams. The 49ers, a 1.5-point road favorite, and I put that term in quotation marks, for their trip down to SoFi, where we know 49ers fans will turn out like they always do. In Southern California, total in this game, 43.5. The Rams, of course, added rest coming into this spot off of the bye. A pair of top 10 teams from a defensive efficiency standpoint, but the 49ers have had the Rams number 7-1 over the last 8. The lone loss, of course, was the most meaningful game of them all in last year's NFC title. When we hit the rewind button of the Week 4 matchup, San Francisco beat the Rams 24-9 and sacked Matthew Stafford 7 times. Deebo Samuel, his most productive game of the season, 6 receptions, 115 yards and a touchdown, 105 of those receiving yards were of the yard after catch variety. Cooper Kupp, 14 receptions, a career high, 122 yards. The Rams, though, only were able to manufacture a season low 9 points, not finding the end zone a single time. Matthew Stafford turned the ball over twice, one of which was extremely costly, a Talanoa Hufanga pick six that really put that game out of reach. The Rams so far this season have gone under the total in 4 straight games before the bye, 35-point combined points or less in those contests. And as a home underdog, well, it hasn't exactly been the most fruitful role, even if it's a limited sample size with Sean McVay at the helm. The Rams are just 1-4 straight up and ATS in this particular spot. San Francisco, as we talked about on Monday's show, got significantly healthier on both the offensive and defensive side. It didn't pay dividends against the Kansas City Chiefs, but in this particular spot, are the Rams able to rectify all the things that went wrong the first time around, or will it be a meeting for the 49ers defensive backfield and defensive line to meet at the quarterback as they unleash fury on Matthew Stafford?
You know, obviously a massive matchup that's going to go a long way in deciding the NFC West. And 49ers got the best of the Rams in the first matchup. And then the 49ers got the best of the Rams in the Christian McCaffrey sweepstakes. And you kind of hinted at Kyle Shanahan getting the best of McVay in this series. And you look at that, Shanahan is 8-4 straight up against McVay. And he's been an underdog in 9 of those 12 games. And so you just start to look at the formula in the schemes, and that's really why it's been a one-way show here for the 49ers. Obviously, it didn't unfold that way in the playoffs, and that's the big one, but I think it's interesting to think about this game. Another injury report game as well. I mean, just unreal, but we'll touch on some of those injuries in a moment. But I think the two things that are crucial to this matchup, one on each side of the ball, and you're looking at a 49ers defense and the way they've specifically defended the Rams, and you can rewind the tape on any matchup between these two that we've broken down over the last handful of seasons, one of which was on a Monday night where we had the best bet on the under. The reason the 49ers have been so successful is they can get pressure with their front four, and they can play lots of coverage behind it with plus linebackers and coverage as well. And, you know, despite some of the D-line injuries throughout the course of the season, the 49ers are second in pressure rate. They're 9th in pass rush win rate. And the Rams, they're 24th in pressure percentage allowed and 27th in pressure that converts into a sack. And the man that replaced all-world left tackle Jason Whitworth got injured before the bye. He's not going to play. So Joseph Noteboom is out. He played in the Week 4 matchup, and Stafford was still under pressure on more than 41% of his dropbacks in that game. So let's see what McVay comes with off the bye. It does look like some offensive players are trending up for the Rams. You have starting center Brian Allen, who did not play in the first matchup, trending well. Van Jefferson looks like he's going to play. Let's see if Kyron Williams gets sprinkled in here a little bit. For the 49ers defense, though, and this is something that was massive last week, Chevarius and Jimmy Ward aren't 100%. Mosley, we know, is out. Jason Verrett does appear like he's going to be cleared and see his first action of the season. Dre Greenlaw didn't finish last week's Chiefs game with a calf injury. Armstead still working his way back. Samson Ebukam battling a lower leg injury. So some of those guys are going to miss. Some of them aren't going to be 100%. You have to keep your eye peeled on that injury report. Quickly on the other side here, Todd, offensively, I'm interested to see what Kyle Shanahan does without Kyle Juszczyk, and I think most people are going to laugh at a fullback being valuable. But the 49ers offense has been wildly more efficient with Kyle Juszczyk on the field. You just have to, I mean, you can see it, right? I mean, defenses have to play differently when he's out there, and he can be a great lead blocker. He can catch passes out of the backfield. He can be a decoy. He forces your defense to show its hand. And what we've seen for many years, and specifically through the early part of this season, EPA numbers enhance when Kyle Juszczyk is on the field, and Shanahan just calls a better game. If you look, Shanahan runs from 12 more when Juszczyk is available. Shanahan runs from 11 more when he's not, and it's substantially less efficient. And, you know, because Juszczyk can catch passes, but also within that, the formations are heavy, which again is kind of that decoy formation. Are we running? Are we passing? Jimmy G's passing EPA is way better when Juszczyk is out there as well. And that ability to be multiple and versatile offensively is really the other reason the 49ers have had success in this series, right? I mean, you think about the Rams defensively, it's like this star-studded group where we have 3-4 really good players, but the way Shanahan runs the offense is he disguises things. And because he's versatile, you can call a game where you negate the stars and focus on the 7 or 8 pawns that are out there. And that's ultimately been the ace up his sleeve. The thing here on this side of the ball, though, you're going to have to keep your eye on Deebo Samuel. Hasn't practiced yet this week. The injury appears to be more than a bump or a bruise. The game is certainly vital, but the 49ers do have a bye on deck, so keep your eyes peeled there. We also saw Trent Williams returned. Valiant effort, obviously. Not 100%. So this side of the ball is a little beaten up as well. The Rams do get the advantage of the rest and out of the bye and have the ability to tweak a few things here. And so that's kind of the element of potential surprise. If there's not out of the bye, it just kind of proves Shanahan's dominance over McVay once again.
Now, I know it's not going to impact the overall handicap of the Rams 49ers game this weekend, but yet again, the Rams find themselves linked to a couple of high-profile difference makers in the trade market. Do you believe there's a little bit of substance behind the style, whether it be Brandon Cooks coming over from Houston or a potential edge rusher in the form of Brian Burns from Carolina or Bradley Chubb from Denver, as the Rams look to try and generate a little pressure off the edge, an area where they've been extremely deficient so far this year since they weren't able to keep Von Miller in Rams colors?
It's a really tough question. I would see how this plays out, but obviously the rumors of Bradley Chubb have been strewn about, and If Denver loses, you mentioned that fire sale at the top, and there's obviously a relationship between the two organizations, and they understand a deal was easy to get done last time. And so you kind of go back to some of those business partners, right? And so let's see what Bradley Chubb would provide this defense. Brian Burns is just a pressure monster, even though some of the sack numbers aren't great. Personally, I don't think the Rams are close enough, but I'm sure they believe they are. I'm sure they see themselves getting a little bit healthier, right? Troy Hill is, should return for this one, which is a nice piece for that unit defensively. And you look at the landscape of the NFC and you're like, this thing's freaking wide open. So I get it. I just don't know how good they are. Brandon Cooks would be a huge boost to this offense, though. And I understand he's been traded all about. But I think maybe they test the waters and see what Van Jefferson brings. And you certainly have the locker room that's still open for OBJ. So does it make sense to go that route and give up assets when you can, you know, for Cooks, when you can hopefully get OBJ back at a cut rate in a couple weeks? Who knows?
Yeah, that's the $100 million question. The Rams, I think, to your point, see the NFC landscape as being wide open, a chance to defend their conference crown. But even if they're able to go out and fortify their offense or defense in any capacity before the trade deadline, they are still a far cry from the elite teams in the National Football League, not just in the NFC, maybe in the form of the Philadelphia Eagles, but the heavy hitters that we see in the AFC, in the Buffalo Bills, and, of course, the Kansas City Chiefs. Speaking of the Bills, we get to see them fresh out of a bye in prime time Sunday night as an 11.5-point favorite, welcoming in a struggling Aaron Rodgers Green Bay Packers squad. Total on the game, 47.5. And the Bills Payne are seeking their best 7-game start in the franchise since 1993, when they went on to lose in the Super Bowl against the Dallas Cowboys. Meanwhile, Green Bay on the other side of things, off to their worst 7-game start with Aaron Rodgers as their starting quarterback. And Aaron Rodgers, never been more than an 8.5-point underdog in his career, according to ESPN stats and info. 234 career starts, includes regular season and the playoffs, are the most by any quarterback to never be a double-digit underdog in the Super Bowl era. Rodgers, however, is 0-4 straight up, including the playoffs, as a touchdown or more underdog. Only Tom Brady has a longer distinction in all of that. But the silver lining for Green Bay, maybe you've already hit rock bottom. Maybe Aaron Rodgers can channel some of his primetime mystique that we've seen out there. The last time the Packers were a double-digit underdog, week 12, 2017, at the Steelers, with Brett Hundley starting at quarterback. Payne, we know that the Bills are an absolute juggernaut. The defense has exceeded expectations. Josh Allen playing at an MVP-like level, which is why he is the favorite to take home that particular hardware. Does Green Bay have any path, I'm not going to say for an outright win, but to keep this game competitive and keep us from turning off the football game before it gets to halftime?
You know, I mean, the line is probably shocking to some. It certainly was me at first blush. And then I looked at our numbers and was like, okay, not off at all. And
we actually made the game 27.5. There's value on the favorite here at less than 2 touchdowns.
No. We were at like 10.4, right? I mean, just, I was surprised to see that. And I think it's going to shock some people, but we have the Packers power rated worse than an average football team right now. And what's concerning to me is we've been waiting for the light to come on for a few weeks now. It's Aaron Rodgers, right? Two good running backs, an offensive-minded coach that's won 13 games, three straight seasons, and you have a defense we all thought would improve year over year. And so surely Green Bay is going to turn it around in the NFC, which is no one's really widening that gap or proving that they're just elite. And I watch every single snap multiple times, and when I'm done doing that for the Packers, I just shake my head and I say, wow, where is the freaking talent? I mean, who on this roster is good enough to fundamentally fix the Packers' problems?
Aaron Jones.
I would agree. They just don't give him the ball enough. Last week, we saw in catch-up mode. I mean, the guy is just a problem out of the backfield. He's probably their best receiver, as crazy as that's going to sound. I mean, he's just dynamic, but they don't give him the ball enough. But that, I guess, is the guy, if you increase his usage rate, maybe you see some help there. But when I look at this, it's very clear Aaron Rodgers does not trust LaFleur's system right now. Aaron Rodgers does not trust his offensive line. Aaron Rodgers does not trust his weapons outside of the aforementioned Aaron Jones. And it's kind of created this Big Ben-like situation where he's hot potatoing the football. I mean, Rodgers right now has the second fastest release time. And what we saw against Washington, Rodgers averaged 2.9 completed air yards. It was the second lowest rate of any quarterback last week. 83% of Rodgers' pass attempts were quicker than 2.5 seconds and within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage. And then you also look, right? Five times this season, Aaron Rodgers hasn't recorded a single scramble. That's nearly double his entire 2020 season rate, which indicates maybe, you know, some self-preservation is taking shape here. And you just look, even the numbers from a clean pocket, Aaron Rodgers is in the 11th percentile in EPA per dropback. And then you think about the injuries, right? David Bakhtiari still dealing with the knee. Says one day it's fine, next day it's a real problem. He couldn't play last week. Elkington Jenkins battling an issue. Alan Lazard left the Washington game with a sling on because of a shoulder injury. Hasn't practiced yet. And then you have, you know, the law firm there of Watson and Watkins. They're both dealing with hamstring issues. Rodgers, right? Thumb on his throwing hand isn't 100%. And it's not working right now. And it just doesn't feel like there's an apparent fix. And it's not just the offensive side of the ball, right? I mean, Green Bay's 25th in schedule adjusted defensive efficiency. It was a unit that was built to defend the pass. And it was built that way because they anticipated that Aaron Rodgers and Matt LaFleur could build leads. And the scary part about the Packers' defensive woes, Todd, when I look at this, who the heck have they played? It's the fourth easiest schedule of offenses.
It ain't a murder. It ain't a murderer's row. That's for damn sure.
No, and you just look, like, while the passing defense on the surface appears above average, they're really sensitive to some specific types of passes that might not bode well in this matchup. And I would also keep an eye on Rashawn Gary. He's graded out the Packers' best defender. He's in the concussion protocol. These have trended towards players missing the following game at an increasing rate. So I don't really know if I want to dabble with the Packers, although I think that's certainly the side you're going to see from pros. I just don't like who the Packers have played defensively and seeing what they've done defensively. This is a massive step up in class for that unit as well.
Yeah, a game on paper that we thought was going to be star-studded and worth its weight in gold early on when you looked at Sunday Night Football. Clearly one team going in the wrong direction and a Buffalo team continuing to assert its dominance as not only the team to beat in the AFC, but maybe the entire National Football League. We'll see what kind of wrinkles that Sean McDermott, Ken Dorsey, and company were able to put together coming out of the bye against the Green Bay team that you mentioned. Has struggled offensively to find an identity and a defense that we were all very high on coming into the year that hasn't exactly lived up to expectations. Because game state is not how they've been built. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Follow the podcast as always, Bet the Board Pod. And if you're not already listening to our variety of other shows, encourage you to do so. College football every Wednesday, National Football League, Good, the Bad, the Ugly, our Monday Night Football editions with game previews on Mondays, our sports cards and collectibles show, fresh episodes coming periodically on Mondays and Tuesdays is the schedule I believe you guys have identified, and only two races left in the NASCAR postseason for our Stay Green podcast. That'll drop with a fresh episode tomorrow in anticipation of Martinsville. But Payne, before we get out of Dodge and we take a little break from one another and our listenership to get back in the lab and try and identify some investing opportunities both on the college and NFL side, what have you found for an actionable element this fine Thursday?
We talked a little bit about this off air, and I think this is the one we ultimately go with. It's 265, the New England Patriots. And you look at this matchup for the Jets and Elijah Vera Tucker, who moved to right tackle in week 5, who's been absolute nails for the Jets, easily their best offensive lineman. He's out. At age 37, Dwayne Brown hasn't returned to form the last 3 weeks after returning from his injury, still dealing with a little bit of a shoulder problem that's forcing him to miss some practices or be limited. I mean, past Connor McGovern, the rest of the Jets offensive line really leaves much to be desired here. And what was masking some of the Jets O-line deficiencies was Breece Hall. He's 5th in defensive adjusted value over average at the running back position. Elijah Moore is asking to be traded. Corey Davis is battling a knee injury. And you look at defensively for New England. And I understand this might be tough to absorb after what you watched unfold in front of your face on Monday evening.
Throw out Monday night. But, throw it out. Remove it as a bad data point.
But New England is sixth in blitz rate and they're third in pressure rate. Zach Wilson has been pressured on 36% of his dropbacks, and he's got a 13 passer rating when pressured. Worst among qualifying quarterbacks, worst in EPA per dropback when pressured. And on the other side of the ball, I absolutely believe Robert Saleh's defense has improved with the infusion of talent. But the last 4 weeks, when they're stringing these wins together, it's a third-string quarterback in Skylar Thompson. It's a backup in Brett Rypien. It's a combination of Mitchell Trubisky, who was benched for a backup rookie, Kenny Pickett. And then you have the aforementioned Packers offense that's in the bottom third of the league in success rate since week four and just trending miserably. So I really think the Patriots can get on track here. Mac Jones is inserted back into the lineup. I think that is their best option as we saw unfold. And I understand Mac didn't come out of the gate strong and he threw an interception that was a fantastic one-handed catch by Brisker. And you can certainly be a prisoner of the moment and look at Bailey Zappe, who comes in fresh off the bench and creates two touchdown drives. Please watch them. Okay. I mean, there's one receiver that is so open that it would be impossible to make a terrible throw. And that's what Bailey Zappe did. Fortunately, Jacoby Myers was able to contort, dive, and crawl his way into the end zone. And then you had a 50-50 ball that Devontae Parker caught down the sideline. Past that, Bailey Zappe's deficiencies with arm strength and size were on full display. So I think you have the better quarterback in Mac Jones back. He appeared healthy too, right? I mean, how many times did he take off last week and be a willing runner to start that game? So he'll have another couple days in terms of health improving that ankle. And this just feels like desperation mode. You can't let the Jets get out in front. Now, I will say this. It's not just who you bet, but it's how you bet. Okay, and that's something we've talked about for a very long time on this podcast. Personally speaking, I'm going to be betting the New England Patriots on the money line minus 123 at Pinnacle. The money line is the better option up to minus 132 when comparing it to 2.5 flat. So that is personally what I'm going to be doing on this game. So New England Patriots on the money line for me in this spot.
Like it. Little bounce back. A team that's had their opponent's number. I believe it's 12 straight meetings the Patriots have won against their rivals in the AFC East. And while there may eventually be a changing of the guard there, I don't anticipate it happening as soon as Sunday. One last question I want to ask. When you watch this Jets team, and obviously an increased level of optimism, they're a half win away from exceeding oddsmakers' expectations with their win total. Zach Wilson, over the latter half of this schedule, do you see a scenario where the Jets could be in the market looking for a new quarterback if they believe that's the only piece that this team needs to take them into that next level and start to have them flirting with division titles or at least playing second fiddle to Buffalo because the Bills aren't going away?
Did you just ask for a TV hot take on Zach Wilson?
I wanted your honest assessment of Zach Wilson and where he is at this point in his NFL career.
It's not good.
Okay. That's all I was looking for.
Some of the pressure numbers that we just divulged are not good. And I understand he got banged up in the preseason and didn't have a full off season. And last year, he didn't have a full season. And certainly, you want these guys to get more reps. And the talent is just through the roof. I mean, a mobile guy that can throw it a country mile. I mean, what's not to like about that? But these next couple games, right? You have the Patriots, the Bills defensively, and the Patriots again. And so I think that's actually going to be the telling stretch. Now, you mentioned there's some other units there that don't pose much of a threat. But ultimately, I do think this is kind of the year here where they have to figure out the quarterback situation. But based on winning games, right, it's not like they're going to be in position for a massive pick, right? They're probably going to either have to move the board or they go the veteran route. What do you think there? That's ultimately the question, because if you think the defense is improving and certainly the weapons on offense and your health offensive along the offensive line should improve. And, you know, Breece Hall, all the talk is once he returns healthy, that he's going to be the first or second fantasy back taken next year. you got some parts there where you could maybe go the veteran route and slip something in there, as opposed to waiting on a younger quarterback and waiting for him to develop for another 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I'd be of the mindset, go after a veteran. If you feel you have the pieces there, you have a lot of talent that are still on extremely franchise-friendly deals. If you can get a quarterback in there before you have to pay some of these young skill position players, both on the offensive and defensive side, you assume that the offensive line will be significantly healthier next year than what we've seen so far. There's a recipe and a direct path for the Jets to be extremely relevant. Main reason I ask, I know a couple of our most loyal listeners are diehard Jets fans, and they haven't had much to get excited about. So every now and again, I like to give them a sliver of hope to believe that they're headed in the right direction. Reminder, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And if you haven't already subscribed to the Bet the Board newsletter, encourage you to do so. All sorts of great reminders about the variety of shows that are out there, additional prop bets, articles, you name it, everything right there at your fingertips on Fridays to get you in the right mindset to turn a profit at the window each and every weekend throughout the course of the football season. Any final words of wisdom you would like to impart on our listenership, my good man?
No, I think we're good.
All right.
Until Monday.
On that note, best of luck with all of your NFL Week 8 investments and with the New England Patriots ticket in hand come Sunday afternoon. Hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.